Hi, this is Alan Ruff, the Thursday host of A Public Affair. If you have a moment and the resources, remember to support the station. And if you will, head over to WRTFM.org to donate and to see what else is going on at the station.
6'6" above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground. We bring the truth to places truth is never heard before. We bring the sound communication.
And good afternoon. Welcome to this, the Thursday edition of A Public Affair. I'm your host for this hour. My name is Alan Ruff. Now, during the 1970s, people here in the U.S. were riveted by stories of prisoners of war coming home from Vietnam. As the press circulated legends of heroes who endured torture rather than reveal sensitive military intervention, news leaks suggested that others had denounced the war in return for favorable treatment. But what really went on behind the walls of Hoa Ho Lo Prison, a.k.a. The Hanoi Hilton? The truth is that the press covered up something quite critical, that U.S. troop opposition to the war was so genuine and so widespread that it even emerged from within the walls of the prisoner of war camp at Hanoi. With us to discuss the story of POW anti-war dissent and, importantly, its long-ago disappearance down the memory hole are Tom Wilbur and Jerry Lemke, co-authors of the about-to-be-released Dissenting POWs from Vietnam's Hoa Lo Prison to America Today. The book, of course, is a major challenge to the conventional accounts of the POW experience and a debunking of the legends that have grown around it since. Tom Wilbur has traveled to Vietnam more than 30 times as a researcher and a lecturer at Hanoi University. His early research on U.S. prisoners detained in North Vietnam from 64 to 73 became the source for the 2015 award-winning The Flowerpot Story. Tom has also assisted in special exhibitions at the prison in Hanoi. Jerry Lemke, I must mention, a one-time Madison guy. Jerry Lemke is a historical sociologist and activist scholar who also wrote The Spitting Image, Myth, Memory, and the Legacy of Vietnam, and an additional work, Hanoi Jane, War, Sex, and Fantasies of Betrayal. He's professor emeritus at Holy Cross College in Worcester, Mass. Tom Wilbur and Jerry Lemke, welcome to WORT.
Oh, thanks, Alan. Good to be with you.
Let's start with some brief descriptions, some overview of the. Let's start with some brief descriptions, some overview of the book. What did you guys set out to do, and of course, why such a book now?
Well, I think the now part is in that campaign slogan for the Trump movement: "Make America Great Again." And the again, for people who are drawn to that, is the time before the war in Vietnam. And they feel that the war and the loss of the war knocked America off its perch. And that we lost the war because of betrayal. And we didn't lose the war to this small, underarmed, underfed nation of Asian others. We lost the war because we were betrayed on the home front. We were sold out by fifth columnists, working behind our back, liberals, radicals in the streets, and so forth. And that betrayal narrative really got started with the POW story after the war. And the claim believed by a lot of people that some POWs were left behind. They were sold out. They were forgotten by the Americans, and that really kind of grabbed people, because the POWs were kind of built up in American mindsets as heroes. They had held out against torture and Oh, sorry, that's my phone. I think maybe you're hearing. And that was, that gained currency because they were able to say, look, we held out against this while these other guys, some weaklings, actually revealed sensitive information to the North Vietnamese guards. They were weak. They were weaklings. And so they became kind of the mythical anti-hero in the story. And those are the people primarily that Tom and I write about in our book. There were dissenters. They came out against the war while they were still held as prisoners. And we think their story has been misused. And Tom and I set out to kind of correct the historical record on that.
Well, the corrective is fascinating to me. Primarily, as I was reading your book, I thought to myself, I've never heard of any of this, really. Right? And I came up through the anti-war movement, coming of age. I'm a historian of the period. And I thought, you know, well, the only images I had were of the official story guys, the prisoners at war narrative, and so on. So it's a fascinating story. Let's talk about who the dissenters were. First of all, maybe some numbers. How many people were being held? How many dissenters were there, maybe approximately? Tom Wilbur, can I bring you in?
Sure, yes. So there were 591 prisoners were released after the signing of the peace accords over about a two-month period till the last group came in March 29th of 1973. That population was varied a little bit. There were actually, a lot of people don't realize, 20-some civilians in that group. Mostly U.S. government civilians that have been caught up somewhere. There were a small group that had been transferred from the South and up to Hanoi for release during that period. But the bulk of them were, majority of them were Air Force pilots and Navy and Marine Corps aviators. That was the bulk of them, Air Force pilots who flew from primarily from some bases in Thailand and some Navy Marine Corps pilots who flew from aircraft carriers and some Marine Corps pilots who flew from bases just below the DMZ. So mostly pilots. And that's what you find. Vietnamese people refer to the prisoners as the pilots, although there were some medical officers, a few medical officers there. There were some enlisted Air Force crews, bomber crews, maybe from a lot of the B-52s that were shot down. And then a small minority group, which was the enlisted soldiers, mostly infantry, ground troops, Marine Corps, and Army, some helicopter crews that had been captured. Many of those were captured just below the DMZ and then transported into North Vietnam and eventually made their way into the prisons around Hanoi. So that's a kind of a snapshot of the population.
Mm-hmm. In the book, at one point, a couple points actually, there's talk about some guesstimates of perhaps as many as 30% of the POWs may have spoken out against the war while still in Hanoi. That to me is rather fascinating. When we talk about the dissenters, who comes to mind? The book has a section of brief biographies, but give our listeners a sense of some that you became familiar with, just one or two. Jerry?
Right. So the dissenters go ahead.
Well, we talk about, we use two of the pilots as kind of the focal figures, Ed Miller and Gene Wilbur. And And then also some of the dissenters from the South, from taken in the South Vietnamese, the ground troops and helicopter people that Tom mentioned. And the thing that we find that's pretty consistent is that most of the dissenters were from modest class backgrounds. They were working class, or they were rural. They were the pilots, Miller and Wilbur, who were dissenters, were not graduates of military academies or colleges. They were up from the ranks, up through the ranks, people. And that really distinguished them from the larger group, the so-called hero pilots, who were from more privileged class backgrounds. They had gone to a lot of them had gone to military academies at Annapolis or the Air Force Academy. Some of them had degrees from major universities, Stanford University, master's degrees, that sort of thing. So that class background is really important because the dissenters, what we found, particularly those who were taken in the South, they were able to really identify with the situation that the Vietnamese were in. They were able to empathize with the Vietnamese. They were able to see the Vietnamese peasants as maybe the farm families that they were from before they went to Vietnam, or they could able to identify with them as working people people who were oppressed and in a really bad situation by the occupation of U.S. troops in the South. And that then what we say, that's really the basis for this kind of conscientious rejection of the war on the part of these dissenters.
I was fascinated by the fact that it wasn't just individual dissent. It wasn't that there was actually some organization to it on occasion. Tell our listeners about the Peace Committee, for instance, within the prison. Tom?
Sure, yes. The Peace Committee was a name. Can you hear me? Sure. The Peace Committee.
Yeah, go ahead.
Was a name attributed to eight enlisted prisoners who were all in a camp called Plantation, about 1 mile north of the main prison at Hoa Lo in Hanoi, just a little bit to the north of downtown. And this this group of eight enlisted prisoners was given the name the Peace Committee by others, mainly as a form of denigration of what they were doing. I think the other prisoners gave them the name, but the name stuck, and I think the Peace Committee held that name proudly. But again, they were eight enlisted prisoners in a camp who joined together when the bulk of them came from southern camps and got consolidated up into Hanoi for about 2 years before the peace accords were signed. And then once the peace accords were signed that time, they were moved on into the main camp at Hoa Lo. We write a lot about their background, the diversity of their background and experience in the book. And I think that's critical, what some of the things that Jerry's been talking about. They had a lot of other experience that told them otherwise when it came to their captors. And so they had a good perspective on what was going on from the ground.
You're listening to Tom Wilbur. and Jerry Lemke, co-authors of the soon-to-be-released Dissenting POWs from Vietnam's Hoa Lo Prison to America Today, coming out soon, next week. We'll be opening up the phone lines at about half past the hour at 608-256-2001, extension 9, if you care to join us with a comment, an observation, a question.
Alan, if I could just add something to what,
please.
What Tom was saying. The people who were captured in the South had met and come to know the Vietnamese before they were captured. Whereas the pilots who had flown off aircraft carriers or had flown over from Thailand and were shot down, they had never been in Vietnam until they were shot down and captured. They literally, most of them, maybe some exceptions, some of the Air Force people did fly out of bases in South Vietnam. But otherwise, these pilots would have never ever seen the Vietnamese. And so there was that fear of the Asian other that was, you know, that brought with them when they landed, not so pleasantly, in a rice paddy in Vietnam, and so that too is an important part of the story.
Again, we'll be opening up the phone lines at half past the hour at 608-256-2001, extension 9, if you want to join the discussion today with Tom Wilbur and Jerry Lemke. Let's talk about the dominant narrative regarding the dissident POWs then and, of course, continuing to this day. There's quite a bit in the book about the psychologizing of the political, the pathologizing of dissent as a system of trauma, and that leads, of course, to the whole business of claims, accusations that these dissenters were brainwashed and become or tortured and so on and so forth. But let's address that. I think it's very important.
Sure. A lot of that has to do with how and why this story gets lost in American memory. When the dissidents come home from Vietnam, they are interviewed by newspaper reporters. Their story does get out, but the validity of that story then gets undermined by claims that, well, first of all, that they were weaklings, and that they sought favor from the North Vietnamese for relief from the harshness of their imprisonment. So the term "men of weak character" is really tagged on them. And then very close to that is that the press treats them as, and this is where the pathologizing comes in, as having come home traumatized, having come home stressed out, and that their story then is one that has been kind of cooking in these harsh conditions of Hoa Lo prison. So while they might be sympathized with, right, we should feel sorry for them, we should maybe see that they get some kind of mental health help, their word isn't necessarily to be used as something to build a political movement around. Their claim that they did this for political reasons or for reasons of conscientious objection really need to be listened to, but really not taken very, very seriously. These are people who came home troubled. And this is not totally different from the way Vietnam veterans who came out against the war in general were treated. The origins of this term, of the diagnostic concept, post-traumatic stress disorder, really is really rooted in that, that the Vietnam veterans who were in the street protesting the war were doing so because they were traumatized. They were acting out on their experience, and this wasn't authentic political behavior. So it was, the way these dissenting POWs were treated and the way their word and their experience was received was very much in keeping with, at the time, sort of the context of the other politicized Vietnam veterans and the way they were and the way they had protested the war and that were then received by the press and the public.
And then, of course, upon their release and return from Hanoi, dissident POWs maintained their conscientious rejection of the war, but were dismissed as communist dupes as well.
Oh, sure. Well, that was very much a holdover from the Korean War narrative. At the time, Americans were more aware of Korean War prisoners who did not come back. I mean, there were some of them that chose to stay in Vietnam, and there was a spate of movies that were produced in the 1950s and in the early 1960s. The Manchurian Candidate, a lot of listeners will remember, and the idea there being that they were, well, yes, they were brainwashed, was the claim. They were duped, and they were tricked. And again, that term, men of weak character, really, that too comes out of the Korean War experience, that they were weak and put in the harsh conditions of captivity, then they kind of did what they had to do to survive. They looked for favors from their captors, and so forth. And so that narrative that came out of the Korean War experience then carries over into the way the prisoners of the American prisoners in Vietnam were thought about. I mean, all along, the American people were saying, gee, I wonder if they're going to be brainwashed, you know, like the Korean War prisoners were brainwashed. And so then when you have this small number of people coming home from Vietnam, you know, admitting, right, that they had spoken out against the war while they were still held in Hanoi, well, it was easy for people then to say, brainwashed, just like the Korean War prisoners were.
That was Jerry Lemke. We're joined by Jerry and co-author Tom Wilbur. We're talking about the book Dissenting POWs from Vietnam's Hoa Lo Prison to America Today. Our engineer today, Shally, tells me that we have an early caller. Steve is on the line, so we can open up the phone lines. Hi, Steve, you're on the air.
Yes, Mr. Ruff, Wilbur, and Lemke. I've studied World War I since the Reagan administration and noticed that the post-war defeated German army's invention of the Dolstosh or backstab legend, scapegoating their defeat on domestic Bolsheviks and Jews, was closely duplicated in the U.S. after Vietnam. I'm referring to the Rambo phenomena, and what I call the black flag of American fascism, the POW/MIA banner insinuating that my comrades are somehow to blame for the abuse of our God-fearing baby killers at the hands of non-Aryan prison guards. By, by what authority does that symbol of cultish stupidity today fly over the Capitol buildings of Madison and Washington? I suspect it is an act of political placation to an interest group. Could anybody on today's show comment or enlighten? Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, caller. The
wow.
Yeah, Tom Wilbur, come on in. Hello?
Well, I would have nothing to add. You know, hear, hear.
Yeah.
I would have nothing to add. That's sure. Very well said. Very well stated.
Well, it's interesting because, I want to encourage our caller to check out the book because there's quite a bit about it. And in a sense, you actually preempted a series of questions because I, too, have been long fascinated by the ongoing, the fact that, as was mentioned, the POW MIA flag now flies, I think, from every state capitol, if I'm not mistaken, in the capitol in Washington, D.C. It's here in Madison. And it's been part of a campaign to, I think, cast doubt, aspersion, not only on dissenting vets and so on, but upon that stabbed in the back by whom, that Jerry already touched on, liberals, liberal politicians, careerists who wanted to work on rapprochement with the Soviet Union and China to advance their own careers. That theme comes out in the Rambo movies. It comes out in the Chuck Norris stuff and so on.
Yeah, well, the POW MIA flag actually flies every day in Massachusetts over every state building. So different states have different laws on this is my sense of it, and that's the law in Massachusetts.
Right.
And of course, that the origins of the flag are in the mythology, again, that some POWs were left behind and that they languished in bamboo cages, you know, for years and decades after the war. So this, again, this POW thing is really at the core of that betrayal narrative for why we lost the war. And that narrative then that America was greater before the war than it is today, and that we need to go back somehow to that period of time. We go back to when America was great. And there's also a very strong theme, very strong thesis in there, which your caller, by the way, touched on this, to avenge that betrayal, right? We got it in Germany, of course, it took the form of going after Jews, homosexuals, communists. And by the way, in Germany, after World War I, there were stories that circulated that German veterans were being spat on upon their homecoming, and the spitters were women and young girls. And that's very much the same story then that is told in the United States, which is the source then of a lot of anti-feminist and misogynist stuff that we see, you know, very, very much evident also in the Trump movement. So all of this is definitely of a piece, and your caller really nailed it. has really been able to put it together.
You know, talking before we went on the air, I mentioned that in the American Insurrection, this Frontlines PBS documentary that aired the other night, in sequences some footage from the actual storming of the Capitol on January 16th. The MIA POW.
January 6th, actually, isn't it, Alan?
I'm sorry. You're correct. I stand corrected. I know why I say that. Yeah, the POW MIA POW flag was quite visible in a couple of shots amongst all the other flags and banners. 256. Yeah, go ahead.
It's just very much a symbol, right? It's an emblem. It's the flag of a social movement.
Let's go back to the phones. Now that we've opened it up, we'll see where this goes. Hello, Ron. You're on the air.
Thank you, Alan, for the show, and thank to the guests being there. My question revolves around the issue of reparations that we agreed to when the Vietnam Peace Agreement was made. It still has not been paid, and also the fact that some of these pilots, like McCain, refused to apologize for the bombing of and the killing they did on a mass scale. These bombers literally killed hundreds of thousands of people, and so I think a reckoning should be made of that as well. And I'd like to hear from your guests about what efforts are being made on the international arena to pay the Vietnamese the reparations they're due through the treaty that we signed. And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Thanks, Ron.
Tom might have more to say on this. I mean, this is really outside the scope of our book.
Sure. Yeah, gladly.
Please, Tom.
Yeah, so I think, you know, part of that is that a bit of a nuance here is that the reparations were not part of the peace accords. I think, if I recall the history correctly, even our Congress didn't see the reparations offer until about 4 years after the letter was written. President Nixon issued it as a direct letter as an enticement of the Vietnamese to make sure they would sign the peace accords, and it was a commitment outside of his ability to obligate in terms of obligating any sort of funds like that. Some analysis in history shows that the Vietnamese were well aware that they would not likely see those reparation dollars at all. But a number was put out there, and I believe it's in 1977 is the date that the State Department released that 1973 letter to Congress. And by that time, it was pretty much water under the bridge or over the dam, depending on your perspective. So the Vietnamese, I think, to their credit, continued without that. I know a lot of people bring this up, and we should do something. That in some ways for me ties even back to the earlier observation about the POW MIA flag. It's symbols like the POW MIA flag that are constantly out there to remind us why perhaps we don't need to pay reparations, or perhaps why it is we don't need to face certain realities about our war of aggression against Vietnam, and also then serve to reinforce our current military, reinforce recruiting, reinforcing everything else that we need to be doing, supposedly, as a country. So a great question. I'm personally a supporter that we should do something. I'm very pleased to see the efforts of a lot of NGO organizations who, without help from U.S. funds, are seeking to work on reparations, and also the work that Senator Patrick Leahy has done over the years to keep sort of appropriate funding going towards working on some of these war legacies that remain in Vietnam.
You're listening to Tom Wilbur and Jerry Lemke. We're talking about dissident POWs and the ramifications, the long-term impact of the fact that, well, that history of dissent within the POW camps slid down the memory hole, not by accident, but very consciously forced there by folks who had a different projection, a different idea of where this country could should be heading, and so on. I'm going to come back, Jerry Limpke and Tom Wilbur, to the fact that the PO story was hijacked by the political right. Can we dig that a little, dig that out, excavate that a little bit further? That is, what was the right's agenda in this notion that the government was not telling the truth, especially?
Well, I mean, yeah. That is really what the post-Vietnam War right agenda, I mean, that really began the campaign against government, qua government. You can't trust Washington insiders. I mean, at the time, some of your listeners might remember that that organizations like the John Birch Society, the kind of McCarthyite organization, right, had this idea that the government itself had been infiltrated by communist sympathizers, and the John Birch Society even alleged that the war in Vietnam was prosecuted by communists in the U.S. government in order to discredit the U.S. government and to fuel left-wing opposition to the government. I mean, a very twisted kind of conspiracy theory. But that's where slogans like, you know, "Inside the Beltway" and other anti-government sloganeering really began with that kind of stuff, and as I say, that's the whole Trump movement kind of flows right out of that.
You know, Jerry, you guys mentioned in the book, reminded me that long before Trump's "Make America Great Again," there was Ronald Reagan's "It's Morning in America." We're about to wake up, and in some ways, the predecessor of so much of what is going on today. Again, if you want to join us with a question, a comment, an observation with our guests today, Jerry Limpke and Tom Wilbur, give us a call at 608-256-2001, extension number 9. So we've talked a little bit about the rise of what became the Trump movement. I think it's very insightful on your part that you say that the rise of the Trump movement can best be understood as an extension of the betrayal narrative for the loss of the war in Vietnam. Yeah. But I want to flip the coin a little bit, because I think it's very important too, that the heritage of service members and veterans who acted with conscience to end the war in Vietnam was kept alive in the decades that followed by the men and women who formed the Vietnam Veterans Against the War and related organizations. That anti-war GI movement is too often forgotten, and of course it's been a long attempt to really forget it, silence it, as if it didn't exist. But talk about that a little bit, the influence of the broader GI anti-war movement.
Well, a really good reminder of that movement is David Zeiger's film "Sir, No Sir," that came out in 2006, and listeners should definitely see that. And to answer your direct question there, I think it's had a real effect on the military today. Zeiger's film was widely shown to the Iraq War and Afghanistan War soldiers, is widely shown on college campuses, of course, so that people who went off to these wars may have been students on campuses before they went. So certainly they saw that. And I think that we're on the anniversary right now of the VPAW incursion into the Capitol in 1971, where medals were returned, and that, you see, then was inspiration for Iraq War veterans to do the same thing, to have a similar kind of medal turn in ceremony in renunciation of the war. But a part of this that you didn't touch on that's very important in that question of, so what happened to this story of dissenting POWs is that when they came home in early 1973, the anti-war movement was kind of dissipating. It was kind of breaking up. And so there was not a movement there to embrace them and to write their story, the story of dissent within Wallo prison, to write their story into the history of the larger anti-war movement and even into the history of the VVAW movement. And VVAW had come out of 1967, 68, 69, and was very much a part of the anti-war movement. So if you pick up books today on the anti-war movement of the Vietnam years, you're going to find in it the story of VVAW. But you're not going to find in it the story of dissident POWs. They just never, they came home just a little bit too late, you see, to really get incorporated into. Now, some did. Bob Chenoweth, to whom we dedicate the book, Bob Chenoweth came home and he toured with Tom Hayden and Jane Fonda on what was called the Indochina Peace Campaign in the 1970s. So there were some of those people that did, but it really kind of gets lost, not only in popular culture and in public imagination, but it really kind of gets lost also within the anti-war movement history itself.
You know, while we're at it, let me mention that your book, Dissenting POWs, will be formally released in a little over a week on April 23rd. April 23rd marks the 50th anniversary of the day when over 700 Vietnam veterans, led by the VVAW, threw their medals at the U.S. Capitol building and discussed during Operation Dewey Canyon, April 23rd, 1973. So I think it's a very, you know, I caught that in some of the press releases, a very fitting tribute, really,
sure,
to those war resistors. We have just a few minutes left in the hour. It always goes so fast. If you want to get in with a call, with a question, a comment, give us a call at 608-256-2001. Extension 9. Let's go back. I want to go back to, in a sense, my first question, the importance of this book for the present, right? It's not a dead history. It's very much with us. And I'm hoping, of course, that a younger generation of activists and people wanting to know some of that history could pick it up. But I wanted to get both of your impressions or thinking on its importance for today.
Well, my hope would be that just like the larger VVAW story, that it becomes a kind of a inspiration. I mean, the subtitle of the book is From Wallo Prison to America Today. And we want that voice of conscience, you see, the way we see it, the way we word it in the book, a voice of conscience to be not just a historical fact, right, which is important enough in itself, but we want people to hear that as The same way the voices of many anti-war activists from that era are heard as people who were strong, people who were resilient, people who did what they knew was the right thing to do against, you know, tremendous odds and tremendous repercussions for themselves. And having done this in prison, you see, is just about as hard as it could possibly be. And so that's really my hope, is that it fleshes out that picture of people acting with courage and with conscience, and becomes a kind of a new chapter, maybe, in that larger story.
Tom Olberg, I was fascinated to learn that you've been to Vietnam so many times, so some 30 times or so, and that you've worked in various projects there. Can you talk a little bit about that in our closing moments, some of the work that you've done there and some of the projects?
Sure. So, you know, to talk about just briefly about why we need to talk about this today is that there's this aspect of history that was diminished when it was happening that I think people ought to be aware of, that shows that the American War of Vietnam was questioned widely, not just by hippies and those that we might characterize, but it was questioned widely and among active duty personnel, and even among those active duty person who happened to be wearing prison pajamas, there were also significant numbers of folks who were against the war. And I think it's important that people are aware of this as we go into kind of a 50-year history of those things. Going to Vietnam and uncovering this was, I didn't see where the path was going to go. Where the path went was uncovering and finding the other side of a lot of this story by interviewing the actual prison guards, the prison camp cooks, the former prison camp commander, the wardens and supervisors, who have a lot of detail to support their memories of how things went on and get their perspective. So uncovering a lot of those things, including new documents that had not been seen before, has been a pretty rewarding exercise to go through. There is a whole history that I think people should learn about and understand, and add that to the mix of other things they hear about the history of that period.
Tom, are there sources in English that you would recommend for people that want to look deeper?
Well, I don't want to seem self-serving in this, but I think we have right now the best single source of that, really kind of pulled some of that documentation together. We have extensive references that talk about other supporting documentation, and I wouldn't want to pick out any single one. Jerry, maybe you can think of some, but certainly the work of Bruce Franklin in talking about myth-making in America, and that certainly we found direct ties to that in our story as well. But there's a lot that's been before us. This is the first one to focus in on those dissenting POWs.
We're right getting down to the end of the hour. A final word from both of you for our listeners.
Just gratitude to you, Alan, for hosting us and you know, providing a chance to get this great story out.
Tom Wilbur, a final word?
Sure. Certainly do appreciate the conversation today. Always look forward to talk about this and talk about it more, and appreciate your audience and those that are listening to us.
Well, thank you very much. There's so much in the book, and it was quite a, it was revelatory for me. People should really pick it up when it hits the, when it goes on sale next week on April 23rd. I want to thank Shali for engineering today. I want to thank Rochelle for helping to produce. Next week, my guest will be Michael Clare. We're talking about current wars, current conflicts, and so on. The great peace historian and activist out of Worcester, Mass, if I recall properly. Sorry, Michael Clare. Again, it's been my pleasure having you guys on. I've been your, excuse me, folks, I've been your host for this hour. My name is Alan Ruff, and I'll be speaking with you next week.
Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and support it. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With information that will never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and support it. Ha ha.
Michael, my dear.